Today on Against the Grain. Over the last 40 years, bottled water consumption has exploded. Once a rarefied item, global sales of bottled water dwarf every other beverage, totaling $300 billion a year. Environmental sociologist Daniel Jaffe argues that packaged water doesn't only imperil our oceans and bodies with plastic waste, but undermines safe public water even more than water privatization. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Nestle, Danone, Aquafina, Dasani, and Fiji, these are some of the corporations that bottle or otherwise package water and sell it on a very lucrative global market. In the countries of the global north, fears of impure public water have driven up sales of bottled water, despite the fact that much of bottled water is repackaged tap water. Daniel Jaffe has written about the state of water commodification and privatization in his latest book, arguing that bottled water threatens the future of safe public drinking water. That book's called Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice, and it's published by UC Press. Jaffe is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University. Daniel, how widespread is the problem of unsafe drinking water globally?
Globally, the statistics are contested somewhat. Stats run from something like 800 million people without access to any safe source of water. But many experts say that total is far too low. Something like 2 billion to 3 billion people not having access near or in the home to reliable sources of safe drinking water, I think is probably closer to the picture. There is also a statistic that was highly relevant to the COVID pandemic, which is that roughly 3 billion people around the world do not have the ability to wash their hands in the home with soap.
So this is obviously something that we take for granted in the global north. And well, much of this discussion will revolve around public water supplies and the fight to keep them public. But I wanted to ask you, how did public water become public in the first place and what preceded it?
In the US and North America and Europe, certainly in the up to the 19th century, urban water supply was a real mess and provided by the private sector and water quality, just particularly in cities, growing cities, really very difficult to guarantee. And you had bottled water in that period as one source of, relatively safer water, people getting it from particular springs. And really only in the very end of the 19th century in the U.S., early 20th century, that municipalities, cities, localities, local government takes over the provision of drinking water, recognizing widely that the private sector has utterly failed to guarantee widespread coverage of safe drinking water. And it largely succeeds, this project, aided by the advent of chlorine and this sort of ambitious era of building out these massive public works systems, systems of water treatment and delivery, so that between the turn of the 20th century and the end of the 1930s, for example, drinking water's contribution to this precipitous decline in overall mortality and infant mortality is really quite significant. I think it's like half of the contribution to the decline in total mortality and three quarters of the decline in child mortality is due to water treatment and safe water. So drinking water becomes essentially a public good, and it is taken for granted, I think, for a good chunk of the 20th century as a public good provided largely by local governments. And, at least speaking about the North American picture, the U.S. and Canada, the U.S. something like 85% of residents get their drinking water from a local government, a public entity. the remaining 15% from a regulated private entity in Canada, it's something closer to 90%. And then, of course, you see the arrival of the bottled water industry really beginning in the 80s, but only taking off in the 1990s. That was really the pivotal decade where this industry consolidates, becomes a global industry. PET, lightweight PET plastic becomes available, and you see dramatic increases in the consumption of bottled water around the wealthy nations of the global north.
Right, and then the two sort of parallel tracks that you explore in your book is that of the explosion of bottled water and the privatization of public water. So you were just describing the journey from public water from private to municipal, widespread public water. And then in the last four decades, there has been a push to privatize that water, to privatize water utilities. Who has driven that push, and what have been the consequences?
Listeners will be really well, you know, well familiar with the dynamics of the efforts to privatize drinking water systems around the world, really, certainly driven by debt conditionality attached to debt renegotiation under structural adjustment programs imposed on many debtor nations in the global south by creditors, the World Bank, the IMF, and others. Privatizing municipal water utilities became a condition of that renegotiation, and the social movements that the strong and vocal social movements that rose up to challenge drinking water privatization in many, many nations are probably very familiar to listeners, from the water wars in Bolivia of 2000 and 2005 to protests that have emerged around the world, really, particularly across the global south, but also in the north. In many parts of the US and Europe, private water industry at one point at its peak, I think 70% of that industry was controlled by a group of five companies. The most familiar names would be Suez and Veolia, transnational water service firms. There have been some shifts. Those two companies actually partially merged last year. But there, partly due to the strong pushback and to the fact that it turns out that privatizing public water service for largely poor nations, communities in the global south has turned out not to be sufficiently profitable for private industry. There's been a sort of a counter trend, a trend of remunicipalization around the world, with cities and nations taking back public water systems, or multinational firms, Suez, Veolia, and others, withdrawing from contracts, finding them insufficiently profitable. The track record of those privatizations have been fairly consistent, and actually peer-reviewed literature confirms this. Water rate hikes, problems with unsafe water, failure to sort of expand water systems to unserved populations sufficiently. And in general, the critique is that the need for high returns on investment conflict with the imperative to invest in system expansion and maintenance for the long term. And so that's why critics of privatization, including the global water justice movement, that constellation of communities and activists and NGOs and others, say, you know, private control of drinking water is inimical to realizing the human right to water. And that's a right that was actually only formally declared in 2010 by the United Nations. So, privatization of municipal water, and then a counter trend of remunicipalization or deprivatization. And so that industry is sort of continuing to grow, but I think faces challenges and growing a lot more slowly than many observers had originally expected. And it still is true that nearly 90% of the population worldwide does not get its water from a private water provider. Now, I make the contrast between that and the expansion of the bottled and packaged water industry globally. And I use the term packaged because it really captures the broader range of forms in which commodified water is sold, from, you know, the sort of ubiquitous 20-liter, 5-gallon plastic jugs that are so common around the world to, in parts of West Africa, for example, sachet water comes in plastic, sealed plastic bags, etc. So the packaged water industry, a different set of multinational firms dominates that market. The top firms for really the past two decades certainly have been four household names, large transnational food and beverage firms, Nestle, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and the Danone Group. And there, I think the expansion has been steadier and growth continues, something on the order of 5 to 7% growth per year worldwide continues. And so we're at the point we've got 120 billion gallons of bottled water consumed worldwide, about a quarter of that in North America, about a quarter of that in China, and the rest worldwide. And that growth is particularly rapid in East and Southeast Asia and parts of the Middle East as well, and has really only slowed in certain parts, certain nations in the global north. So that's roughly where we stand today with those two industries.
Well, taking the U.S. as the focus, can you give us an idea of how much bottled water consumption has increased in the U.S. in the last few decades?
Right. So I begin the book with a sort of acknowledging or admitting that I'm old enough to remember a time when, you know, there was essentially no such thing as the product of single-serve plastic bottled water. In the 1980s, I was in grade school, and at that point, 1980, in fact, was the year people in the U.S. consumed on average 2 gallons per capita. And essentially, at that point, it was more or less Perrier in heavy glass bottles, right? It was a sort of a luxury niche commodity. And we've gotten from that with virtually inexorable growth year on year to a point where in 2021, the last year I have good stats, Americans consumed 47 gallons of bottled water per capita. Nearly 90% of people in the U.S. consume some bottled water. And as of the most recent statistics, 1 in 5 people in the U.S., 20% of the population, now gets all of its plain water from a bottle, shunning the tap for drinking entirely. And the industry in the U.S. Had sales of $46 billion last year, and it's a more than $300 billion industry worldwide. And just returning to that contrast between the private water services industry and the packaged water industry, I say we really need to keep our eyes on the packaged water industry, which I think is the fastest growing and probably soon to be the largest form of commodified drinking water worldwide. It's growing far more steadily than the private water services industry, but has gotten less attention, I think, as a modality of water commodification on a global scale.
Right, and you also argue that these are very much tied together. The fate of public tap water, not just from privatization, but from the explosion of packaged water, bottled water. Now, while there are some glass bottles, most bottled water is bottled in plastic. Can you give us a sense of the ecological effects of such a vast amount of plastic being used and usually then discarded?
It is an enormous worldwide ecological problem, a crisis. So first thing to begin with is the fact that bottled and packaged water is the world's most consumed packaged beverage by far, leaves all the others in the dust. That means that it represents the biggest single share of the 600 to 700 billion single-use plastic bottles that are consumed and mostly disposed of every year around the world, something like 34-35% of the total, right? So that its contribution is the most significant there. And, you know, that problem was described in an article in The Guardian a few years ago as nearly as serious as climate change. People listening are clearly aware of the extent of the plastics crisis, but it is enormous. And then to look at the role of this in the other sort of facets of its ecological impact and environmental impact, beverage bottles and caps, of which bottled water is the number one contributor, are the top marine garbage item worldwide, according to one study. Another found that they represented about 50% of all marine garbage. And recycling just really is insignificant when it comes to that. Worldwide, the global bottle recycling rate is something like 7%. In the U.S., it's been creeping down. It's now 26%. All plastics recycling rate in the U.S. just fell to 5%. So it is an enormous contributor. And then going beyond simply the plastics crisis to look at the other environmental impacts of this product, it has an enormous energy footprint. The most reliable study says that bottled water's energy footprint is between 1,000 and 2,000 times greater per unit volume than providing tap water. Its overall environmental impact, a very recent study estimated the total environmental impact is somewhere between 1,400 and 3,500 times greater per gallon, essentially, than the provision of tap water. So it is enormously unsustainable, and it is important to get a handle on that impact.
Environmental sociologist Daniel Jaffe joins me today. We're discussing Unbottled, the fight against plastic water and for water justice. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've just been describing bottled water and all the ecological consequences of packaged water. How pure is it? A driving motivation for many people, many Americans drinking bottled water, is that it is purportedly purer than their tap water. Is that true?
There has been a multi-decade effort, I would say, both subtle and overt on the part of many bottled water firms, not all, the industry in general, to sow doubt, let's say, around the safety and the quality of public tap water supplies. That has been aided, obviously. Let me step back and just say that fear of the tap is the number one driver of people turning to bottled water, packaged water, for drinking. So what is the cause of that fear? Certainly one is marketing that subtly or overtly raises questions and fears about tap water quality, but it has been aided by a number of other things. The environmental movement, which the passage of the Safe Drinking Water Act in the 1970s, requiring water utilities to provide abundant information about the contaminants in water supply, so that information is available, and it turns out that there is an extremely unlevel playing field when it comes to the regulatory frameworks between the bottled water industry and public water utilities. Public water utilities are regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Safe Drinking Water Act, required to report contamination events, required to publish annual water reports, detailed water reports, including the different contaminants that are found and what levels they're at. Most water utilities are required to test their water tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of times yearly, whereas the bottled and packaged water industry, partly because I think of its political clout, its lobbying might, is regulated by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, under a far weaker regulatory regime, not necessarily in terms of the thresholds for the contaminants, which are roughly similar to those of tap water, but in terms of the enforcement and the monitoring provisions. The contrast between FDA regulation and EPA regulation is really that between night and day, and this creates a disparity where consumers are far, far less likely to find out in the event that contamination is detected in bottled water. Recalls are rare. It is unlikely that you would find out if bottled water had been recalled. And that opacity, that inability to access information about contamination, obviously benefits the industry. In addition, FDA regulation, FDA inspection has progressively been sort of defunded over the years. Inspections happen less often. The companies actually test water quality themselves. The FDA does inspect the plants, but less and less frequently. And it turns out that almost two-thirds of bottled water, because it doesn't cross state lines, is actually not even subject to federal regulation, only to state regulation. There has been a lot of concern about what is in tap water, and then newer studies coming out giving us a better picture of what bottled water contains. So I'm talking here about the context in the U.S., North America. Recent studies looking at microplastics contamination have shown, peer-reviewed studies show that someone consuming only bottled water would consume 22 times more microplastic fragments than someone consuming only tap water in the U.S. There is also significant concern about leaching of various substances, including phthalates and antimony, at high temperatures and when water is stored in bottles for extended periods of time. And so there are a lot of concerns there, but in general, there is sort of an uneven playing field where consumers are far more likely to hear about and know about threats to drinking tap water supplies than to the bottled water they consume.
And isn't it the case that actually most bottled water is tap water?
Yeah, indeed. That is the other side of the picture. It turns out that worldwide, a little less than half of all bottled and packaged water comes from groundwater, comes from springs and other forms of groundwater. In the U.S., it's even less. It's something like a little more than a third comes from springs or groundwater. The remainder is essentially municipal tap water extracted from public water systems, refiltered, minerals are stripped out. Companies then re-add in their own proprietary mineral mixes, right? So that Dasani is going to taste the same in California and Ohio. And I think, not incidentally, that exposure to that sort of consistent bland taste of bottled water probably retrains palates, so that may be one of the reasons why people express dissatisfaction with the taste of their tap water. And indeed, that is one of the great riddles, right? How and why this product continues to be so popular and so successful, given that people are essentially consuming reprocessed public tap water.
How safe is the U.S. public water supply? What do we know about its safety? Obviously, there have been crises, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, like the one that took place in Flint, Michigan, in which residents of that city were poisoned with lead and bacteria containing water and then became reliant on bottled water. That seemed like a red flag for a lot of people, particularly people living in areas where they are the subject to, you know, vast inequality of American society. What can we say about the safety of the U.S. public water supply?
Let me start by saying I argue in the book that, you know, bottled water is not just sort of what we've discussed, a controversial product with a commodity with a lot of negative environmental impacts, but that it is also, and its growth is also, deeply connected to the social justice crisis of uneven access to safe and affordable drinking water, not just globally, but here in the U.S. and in North America. And so that, yes, media coverage of tap water disasters like those in Flint, Benton Harbor, Michigan, Jackson, Mississippi, parts, rural communities in California, Central Valley, et cetera, are getting a lot of media attention. What is true is that the great majority of public tap water in the U.S. remains safe to drink, but a small percentage, on average, 7 to 8% of U.S. drinking water systems in any given year will have at least one health-related violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But those violations are not randomly distributed, and of course they're not evenly distributed. They're concentrated where you would expect, perhaps in rural communities, in low-income communities, particularly smaller water systems, and overwhelmingly in communities with larger proportions of African-American and Latino-Latina residents. And so we see a phenomenon where studies document this. It is overwhelmingly low-income and non-white U.S. residents who consistently express greater concerns about their tap water safety, and who also consume the highest amount of bottled water and spend the most on bottled water, something like a 2-to-1 ratio, studies tend to find. And this disparity is really pronounced. So, and it has gotten more pronounced since the Flint crisis. We're increasingly seeing, you know, I think the conventional story and what a lot of writing about the bottled water phenomenon up until about 2010 would say is that bottled water is a discretionary good, right? It is something that is consumed more by higher income people, and the demand is elastic. If people's income goes down, consumption goes down. But it turns out that at least since that time, studies just unequivocally point to a pattern that is exactly the opposite. We're increasingly seeing a dynamic where in the U.S. It is middle and upper income households, white households, that increasingly are turning away from bottled water, returning to the tap, consuming more tap water, and rejecting packaged water, whereas low-income households, communities of color, are consuming more packaged water, relying on it more. One study showed that 57% of all plain drinking water consumption by volume among Black and Latino adults was bottled water versus only 30% of the volume for white adults. So the disparity is really significant, and it is getting more so. And we have a situation, therefore, where this is essentially a symptom of a water justice crisis, right? Where the communities who on average are least able to afford this extra spending on bottled and packaged water for a variety of reasons, including what I think can fairly be said to be a rational, logical reading of the uneven distribution of drinking water problems in the U.S., are choosing to depend on bottled and packaged water for their drinking supply and sometimes even for cooking. And that can represent a really enormous expenditure. If we're looking at families replacing their water for drinking and cooking completely with packaged water, that expenditure is well into the thousands of dollars per year. I think that is just a real red flag that points to a crisis of water injustice.
Daniel Jaffe is my guest. We're talking about Unbottled, the fight against plastic water and for water justice. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Daniel Jaffe is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University. Well, Daniel, let's talk about what took place in Flint, which has become a symbol of the mistreatment of a working class and racialized community where people ended up having their health imperiled by public water and becoming utterly reliant on bottled water. Can you place that story, which was in the national media, in its larger political and economic context? What created that crisis and who ultimately benefited from it?
It's important to get a handle on these emerging water disasters like Flint, like the current and ongoing disaster in Jackson, Mississippi, and elsewhere. The backdrop, well, it's a two-part story. One is a nearly 50-year progressive defunding, federal defunding of maintenance of public water infrastructure. A kind of austerity that has happened really since the late 70s, where federal spending on public water infrastructure, you know, we moved from an era of revenue sharing in the 1970s and large expenditures on sort of building out pipes and helping municipalities maintain their systems. That money has dwindled down, a drop of about 80% over nearly 50 years, and that has caused a massive backlog of deferred maintenance by local water utilities. Pipes are aging. The average age of pipes is creeping up. That fiscal pain has been pushed down onto localities and onto states, you know, many of whom do a fantastic job and have sort of come up with the money, But that has resulted in rising water bills across the country as they have to raise rates and taxes to make up the difference. And so that has led to now a very severe national crisis of drinking water affordability, and even leading to water shutoffs for millions of people, which we can talk about later if you want. And then the second is sort of a more direct chain of racialized austerity, for example, in situations like Flint. You know, the Flint crisis, listeners know this, is related to the fact that Flint and many other Michigan cities were placed under emergency management by the Republican governor, emergency managers overriding local democratically elected officials to make unilateral decisions like the transfer of Flint's water source from the Detroit municipal system to the contaminated Flint River. And so, you know, of course, in an immediate context of toxic drinking water, of course, people need an emergency water source. And I talk about how residents in Flint, activist groups in Flint, in the early days after the contamination was revealed, demanded and eventually received distribution of free bottled water as an emergency water source. But the question is, what happens after the immediate emergency? And I think what happened in Flint, there was a demand on the part of residents and the part of activist groups there, and the Michigan governor even applied to the federal government under the Obama administration for a major health disaster declaration, which, according to many residents, would have led then to the provision of bulk safe water distribution, right? Water tankers, these tankers called water buffaloes, that would have come in and people could have brought their own containers in and filled up in bulk. And that declaration was denied by the Obama administration. And so partly for that reason, as a result, through the duration of the disaster, single-use, single-serving plastic bottled water, we all seen the images, hundreds of millions of bottles of it, became the sole face, the sole alternative water source on offer to Flint residents. And that emergency declaration was provided, distribution was provided by the state of Michigan for a couple of years. Then it was taken over by Nestle, who donated its water that was bottled across the state for very low cost. And then the free bottled water distribution ended at the end of last year. And many residents continue to distrust the tap water despite local officials' claims that it's been rendered safe, and continue to purchase bottled water. And that indicates a kind of a pattern that I talk about, where I think if we look at settings where communities are dependent on bottled and packaged water, I think we can see that a pattern where, whether it is in communities faced by toxic water crises here in the north, communities unable to access safe water, or in parts of the global south, wherever there is dependence on bottled and packaged water, no matter the reason, I think that is a marker of water injustice. It's an indication that the human right to water is being abridged or denied.
So you mentioned the global south, and as you have just stated, of course, there are these emergencies where people need to find alternate sources of water. And in the global south, much of the tap water is not safe for drinking. But I wonder if you could tell us how the proliferation of bottled water actually impedes the fight for clean public water in places where the water, the tap water at this point, is not safe for people.
There are parallels between these environmental justice or water injustice crises of unsafe tap water in the north and the settings that you're just describing across the global south. That dependency that I just mentioned is part of it. And I think that in these settings, overall, there is a pattern where bottled and packaged water's ready availability weakens the perceived urgency or the political pressure for fixing, expanding, extending, building broken or non-existent drinking water infrastructure. And I think it allows dependence on bottled and packaged water to persist. Now, talking specifically about the global south, I think that we obviously have to be very careful about generalizing, and I do give some examples of specific countries and show the diversity across different settings, and I'll talk a little bit about Mexico if we have a chance. But I think in general, there is a pattern by which governments, states, have often been unable, or in some cases unwilling, to extend drinking water systems sufficiently to meet the needs of either urbanizing or growing populations. The lack of extensive pipe water networks is a legacy of, often in many places, a colonial legacy, right? The lack of building out of drinking water systems, and either faced with that or faced with situations where, because of austerity or structural adjustment or other factors, the state chooses not to or is unable to provide safe, reliable water to a large swath of the population, the packaged water industry, the global packaged water industry, and increasingly sort of a proliferation of small bottlers has been happy to step in and sort of provide alternative sources. So if you, you know, look outside of sort of the cores of many major urban areas in the South, you see residents, middle, you know, and lower income residents having to rely on kind of a mix of informal sources to access drinking water, where it might be a mix of tanker trucks providing deliveries and local vendors selling bottled water of unclear provenance and unclear quality, particularly for working class, middle income and working class poor residents. You see the reliance on what I think has only sort of come to the attention of observers, more recently, a refill water segment, sort of this stratum of really tens of millions, hundreds of millions of in sort of small informal businesses, bottlers that take water either from surface water, groundwater, or the municipal water supply, filter it, and then sell it to folks in their own containers. You come to the local refilling station, you bring your container, you fill it up, and that may account for something like half of the packaged water market globally. That water is of varying quality, but it is currently an important source of water, and many families prefer it, and it tends to cost something between a quarter and a half of the cost of branded water. And so upper middle and upper income consumers in many cities in the global South don't have access to pipe water, or don't trust their pipe water, or where the pipe water is not safe, will consume branded bottled water provided by one of the big four companies or one of their subsidiaries. And that's going to be obviously more expensive. So we've got this sort of two-tier drinking market. And then for the very poorest residents, even the cheapest forms of refill water are really unaffordable. But I also trace a lot of research that looks at the impact of expenditures and dependence on packaged water across the global South. And I go into a little more depth talking about the case of Mexico, because I think it helps to crystallize some of these phenomena. So, you know, in Mexico, we have a situation, a nation that did build out extensive pipe water systems, certainly under the developmental state governments of the 20th century, mid-20th century, up until the 1970s. And in many cities, drinking from the tap was commonplace as recently as the 1970s or maybe even into the 80s. But a series of factors from the peso crisis of the 1980s, severe austerity imposed on Mexico, the Mexico City earthquake, which damaged much of the water system, the cholera epidemic of the 1990s, and then the election as president of a beverage company official, Vicente Fox, the former CEO of FEMSA Coca-Cola, sort of presided over the period of greatest expansion of the bottled and packaged water industry. And Mexico goes from a country where much of the tap water was both widely distributed and potable to the world's number one per capita consumer of packaged water. And between 80 and 90% of Mexican consumers rely on those garrafones, the 20-liter jugs of packaged water for their drinking water. On top of that, the defunding of local water utilities, severe. I cite one study that says that 91% of Mexican water utilities are in debt, unable to invest in system improvement or maintenance. The budget of the federal water agency, CONAGUA, has shrunk dramatically. 2020, it was just over $1 billion, if my source is correct, compared to Mexican spending on packaged water that year of $14 billion. So that is a kind of an extreme situation where large swaths of the population are spending as much as 15 to 25% of their entire household income to acquire water, between accessing packaged water and paying for municipal water bills for water that is not potable. And I think those kinds of patterns of increasing dependence on packaged water or permanent dependence on packaged water is one reason why I think this is a flag for water injustice and a real sign that the human right to water is not being honored. And the last thing I'll say about the picture in the Global South, I talk about a development that happened in 2017. You know, so there is this question: does bottled and packaged water have a legitimate role to play in meeting drinking water needs in parts of the world where, for whatever reason, tap water systems are not safe and or reliable, consistently flowing? Right, rationing of water, an enormous problem in Mexico. What they call tandeo, the rationing of water, you know, 12 hours on, 12 hours off, or 4 days off, you know, one day on, an enormous problem in terms of accessing sufficient supplies of safe water. And this question sort of emerged around the terms underlying global goals for improving drinking water access. So the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals include one goal, goal six, which is dramatically improving the percentage of the world's population who have access to safe sources of drinking water. And in 2017, a little noticed decision, a sub-body of the UN reclassified packaged water as a so-called improved water source for the purposes of meeting the sub-goals of that Sustainable Development Goal 6, so that effectively governments are now allowed to count the availability of packaged water toward the purposes of meeting a progress toward meeting that goal. And critics have really assailed this decision as kind of granting governments an escape clause and allowing them to meet these targets without investing public funds in upgrading or expanding water infrastructure, but highly profitable for the packaged water industry. And so I think this suite of issues is really important to understand and keep our eyes on.
Environmental sociologist Daniel Jaffe is my guest. We're talking about Unbottled, the fight against plastic water and for water justice. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one of the things that you write about is the not just the forces that have been pushing to privatize water and to sell bottled water all over the world, but also the backlash against those forces. And there's certainly been a backlash against bottled water that has been taking place over the last several years and the massive waste that it entails. I wonder if you could tell us how you see that backlash, because you were describing in terms of the consumption, at least in the United States, of bottled water, that there's a class and race-based division that has taken place, that more affluent and white consumers now are moving away from bottled water. Those sort of divisions, can we see them in the forces that are pushing back against bottled water?
Yes. The range of resistance movements, both in North America and around the world, that have kind of responded to or pushed back against this commodity and its growth, try to cast the net broadly and think widely about, you know, what constitutes these movements. And so I look at really, well, first I begin with sort of looking at the history of movements challenging bottled water in North America. And I talk about sort of five major organizations, two in Canada, three in the US, that sort of had led, you know, early campaigns, really beginning at the beginning of the 21st century, around challenging bottled water, raising concern about its environmental impacts, leading networks of universities and municipal governments to begin to pass bans on bottled water purchases. And those major organizations really, I think, provide a bridge between efforts to challenge municipal water privatization around the world and a focus on bottled water. And these groups might be familiar to many listeners, but in Canada, I talk about the Polaris Institute and the Council of Canadians. And here in the US, I talk about Corporate Accountability International, Food and Water Watch, and then more recently, the Story of Stuff Project. Those are sort of the five major North American organizations that have kind of created networks of communities and movements and really push for policy, sort of challenging packaged water. And many of those organizations sort of work on water justice issues as well. And then I look at sort of the two major facets of these movements, one of which I sort of gloss as the reclaim the tap facet. And that is kind of this constellation, really a panoply of incredibly diverse efforts, mostly at the local level, from city governments, you know, passing bans on municipal purchases of bottled water, cities saying, hey, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense. If we are the entity that is providing public tap water to the population, it doesn't make sense for us to be, you know, providing, to be purchasing bottled water for use in the offices, to be putting it in front of city councilors at city council meetings. You know, we're undermining our own public good here. And so, you know, the movement sort of began with that, bottled water bans on municipal purchases, and then it sort of has expanded, I think, over time to more ambitious efforts, right, to ban its sale anywhere on city property. And you get cities around the world, and certainly in the U.S., you know, New York, big in the vanguard here, San Francisco, a real leader, right? They have sort of periodically strengthened their municipal ordinances around bottled water. The city has policies banning its sale on city property, can't have public events in city parks where you sell bottled water, you have to hook up to the municipal supply. And San Francisco's Drink Tap initiative really, I think, is a great example. It sort of represents a vision of access to safe drinking water, to tap water, as kind of a nested public health, social justice, and environmental problem, where it's linked to their efforts to reduce waste, but it's also, you know, building out these shiny new refilling stations and water fountains, bottle refilling stations in all the public schools, in public spaces, in communities particularly, you know, sort of, I think they've really prioritized structurally disadvantaged communities. And so these kinds of initiatives at the local government level, I think, are popping up around the country, around Canada, around the world. And I think it's very exciting. It's actually a really hopeful arena, and it provides just a myriad of access points for concerned citizens and activists to plug in, whether it be, you know, schools, restoring fountains at schools, you know, because, you know, many school districts that have detected problems in their school water have shut off school water fountains. You know, one example among many is the Baltimore City Public Schools, where lead was detected in the water in the school piping in 2002. Right, this was not a problem of the Baltimore City water treatment. This was pipes, internal piping to buildings, and of course they shut off all the water fountains in all the buildings. And really tragically, because of the nature of sort of year-to-year budgeting and the inability to fund the very expensive system fixes to pull out the pipes, a fiscally stressed school district, 21 years later, the vast majority of those schools still are providing bottled water, and the fountains remain shut off. And, despite the fact that the district is spending something like $1 million per year to buy bottled water, it may make sense on a year-to-year basis, but it doesn't make sense sort of in a long-term fiscal sense. Essentially, more than a generation of public school students have gone through those schools, never having had the experience of drinking from the water fountain in the hallway. But there is a great counterexample to that. If we're talking about schools, and it's important to mention, the Detroit public schools, similar situation but a different ending. Detroit schools detected lead in their school water in 2018, again, shut off all the water fountains. But the district was able to come up with, I think they used private philanthropy to come up with only $3 million, bought them lead removing water refilling stations. In all the schools, they gave every one of the 50,000 students in the Detroit school system a metal refillable bottle and sort of reinvigorated a practice of drinking tap water, of refilling. And so that is a hopeful sense and a point of access. And then I think it is partly true that that facet of the movements has emerged and has flourished largely in places with the privilege of access to reliably safe, clean tap water, but not entirely.
Daniel Jaffe, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thanks so much, Sasha. I enjoyed it.
Daniel Jaffe is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University. We've been discussing Unbottled, the fight against plastic water and for water justice. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.